Session number 9938, Reel 6.
Of what, Reel 6?
And who was also the British officer in charge of the cookhouse, the Germans complained to him that the roof of the cookhouse seemed to be caving in. So Crawley, quick-witted as ever, said, oh, it's just your security guards are crawling up there in endless suspicion of everything, and one of them's put his knees through it. So we just had to be more careful next time. We got away with that. And then one morning, I was absolutely horrified to be walking around the camp, a bit of exercise, and I saw a bunch of Germans by the cookhouse, and coming in and out of where the horse was. And I nearly said, oh God, it's all over then, but I managed to avoid any insane remark like that. And we awaited events. And they'd got up the floor of the cookhouse where the horse was normally stored, above which the horse was normally stored, and they were looking underneath these floorboards, which had plenty of fresh sand. I'd been using it as a good disposal place. But they did not, they felt very frustrated, but they did not connect the fresh sand under the floorboard with the horse, which is standing there only a yard or two away, all innocent. And so we breathed again. And so it went on. I remember when the people in the camp, particularly the more seasoned escapers who had attempted escape, and often very gallantly and intelligently and just the luck against it and all that, but they formed a sort of squad of people who didn't quite know it all but knew a lot about escape. And from the start they'd said, well, you won't get away with this. And as the weeks and months went by, they rather changed their tune and started to ask questions about the horse and would there be room for some others on this scheme, this sort of thing. It was quite a change. And so they plied us with these questions, and they said, well, how do you know it's going straight, this tunnel of yours? How deep is it below the surface, and how long is it? And just showing the nature of the horse, we had no answers to any of these questions. And this scientific approach wore us down a bit, and we decided to find out. So one day we put Williams down in the horse, and at that stage we could take two out in the horse at a time. And I was the second one, and Williams went down the box under the horse, having removed the boards, down in the box under the horse, and I tied a Red Cross string to his ankle, several lengths of it, and he disappeared up the tunnel. And the object was he'd lie on his back at the end of the tunnel and poke us a poker up towards the surface, and that people would stop vaulting momentarily and lounge about the horse and look out for the poker. And I would pull the cord, telling Williams, indicating to Williams, you better pull the poker down. But at any rate, we'd see where the tunnel was, where the end of the tunnel was. And well, we did all this drill, and we stopped vaulting, or they stopped vaulting above me. I could hear it going on, and we're leaning against the horse, and I was inside it there, and I thought, this is going on much too long. What the hell's the matter with this? You know, it's quite simple, poke the poker up, and somebody see it, and then tap on the horse, and so on and so on. And then I heard a voice of a little New Zealander called Mackay coming up in a loud way, saying to the vaulters resting and leaning against the horse, hello, you guys, what are you doing? You're tired? You've broken your legs or something? Andy, said, I could hear this through the horse, what's that over there? And apparently, so the chaps on the surface told me, there was the poker sticking up and waving away more or less under the nose of one of the guards in one of the raised sentry boxes. And of course, at that moment, there's complete panic. Various people banged on the horse saying, pull the poker down, get that bloody poker down, pull the poker down. And of course, the only calm one, as usual, was Michael Codner, a very cool cookie.
Michael who?
Michael Codner, who had invented the scheme. The army, British Army officer, he's a calm one, and he said, Ollie, you might pull that poker down, which is, of course, the right thing. So I yanked on the string, and the string broke, and it took an age before it all damped down. And then they told me afterwards, when the horse was in, we're having a shower, one thing and another, I said, what the hell was happening? And they gave this vivid description, and then we got really mocked, you know. You not only have a tunnel which is 30 degrees off course, off track, to one side, but you don't know how deep it was. It happened to be 2'10", and you didn't know how long it was. It was then about 30, 40 feet long, or something of that order. And not content with that, you wave a poker at the goons, and we were met with great scorn after that. However, the thing had this magic life, and then break time was, it started way back in May, and it was going to be 36, 48 hours, something of that order, or even 24, and it's coming up to 4 months and so on. And in October 29th was breaking day, which we settled. And it is very, very difficult to get the thing started. The form was, on that day, Michael Codner was taken out in the horse on an early morning session, and which is unusual, which is dangerous, really, and moved the boards, got into the tunnel, and went up the front of the tunnel, presumably, and was sealed in there. And I sealed him in, and so we got rid of him. And then we had to fudge the count, which was done by a pilot officer lying crank in simmer, sick in bed, and hence not able to come to the regular identity parade. And the pilot officer was counted like that, and then became Group Captain McDonald, and group captains were allowed to prowl around, walk around during the count, and put on his group. He's a mock pilot officer. He jumped out of the window, and he was counted twice, therefore, and therefore they got the numbers okay. So we got over that one. And then in the evening, I remember going down there and to the cookhouse, and there's another parade to be fudged, and so he took a quick look at the horse. It looked all right, and we went out on the parade in our going away clothes. Fortunately, being October and so on, we wore our Polish greatcoats, which concealed the most suspicious set of clothing, including things like bank robbers use, and masks over our masks ready to go over our heads, which we got in our pockets when the time came, and so on. And we had to be behaving well. And still, of course, Mike was away. He was one short. But Feldwebel, the sergeant man, came along, counting our bit of the parade, counting them, and he stopped. I was several rows back, away from the front on purpose, and he stopped dead opposite me and just fighting not to give anything away. I just stayed still. And all he wanted was for me to cover off, as they say, and get in proper line, and then he moved on. And then he had a fit from that, but that was okay. And then Williams and I, who were both very suspiciously dressed underneath these coats, we got into the cookhouse, and the thing was on. And we then, friends are most extraordinary people sometimes. We found people who came into the cookhouse when we were just getting ready to get in the horse for the last time and escape from Stellingdorf 3. They came in to say, well, if you, when you get through, do go and see my wife and all this stuff. And then suddenly, David Lubbock, who was guarding the cookhouse for us and looking out for wandering ferrets, these security guards, said, Charlie's coming in his calm way. And we didn't know what to do, except that the church choir then came in, the Stellingdorf 3 choir of church of prisoners who had a little church service every Sunday and so on. They came in, not knowing anything about the escape, went to the one piano and started playing "And His Angels Shall Uphold and Guide Thee." So we joined here, singing away, we knew not what. We couldn't read music ourselves, I think. And Charlie looked in, and church choirs had never given him any trouble. And he just looked in and looked away again, and then we really got going. And Williams and I got into the tunnel, got into the wooden horse, and we got little Mackay, the New Zealander, who came along, and by writhing away, we in these sort of bank robber suits with our hoods over our faces by now, we wormed and squirmed around and got Mackay poised between us on our knees. And then the word came, lift, and the horse had never had such a load as this ever. And it was getting pretty battered and old by this time. And it groaned and creaked, and a bad moment as it came out of the cookhouse, down the steps, and one wondered whether the whole thing would give way. But it didn't. And people who were guiding it on the surface put it down, and then removed the beams, and awful turmoil in there, squirming about, no room at all, and we managed to lift up the boards, shout up to Michael Codner, say, "You okay, Mike?" And a musty voice came back. He was okay, been down there all those hours. And then Williams went down into the tunnel, disappeared up it, and then I went down, stayed in the box under the horse. And we went on digging a little bit because we got a time to use before it got dark, because we weren't going to try and get out of that thing until it was dark, and it had to be taken in as dusk came. And Williams shunted back some sand, and Michael extended the tunnel a bit longer, and so on and so forth. It got terribly hot. Terribly hot, and I called up to Williams and said, "Look, I've got a stick here that I've taken with me. I must put it up and get an air hole." He said, "It's pretty hot, but it won't. Don't do that. Don't do that. We're going to break in a few minutes." And sure enough, when I got back to underneath the horse, there's a voice from outside. I'd pack it up now. And so Mackay squirmed up into the horse, And we did a sort of boy's own annual shake of the hand. He looked rather forlorn. He wasn't coming, which was known. It was only a two-man scheme and then expanded to a 3-1, and only three people could possibly go. And I shook him by the hand, and then he put the boards over, and I could hear the sandbags being put on top, and we'd really started. And we crawled up, and we'd been, and we were watching the watch carefully, and when we reckoned it was dark, then William said, "Ah, we're breaking now," he shouted back to me, "follow me." And I crawled along the tunnel, touching his kit bag. He always mocked me for the luggage I brought, but he brought a kit bag. And I touched his kit bag and crawled along here, and suddenly he said, keep quiet now, we're breaking. And I could hear Michael Codner, he's obviously carving the way through the roof at the end of the tunnel on the Freedom side, and it was falling in, thud, thud, thud. And I followed his William's kit bag and so on. Suddenly it wasn't there. And I realized that these two had actually got out, because I never gave it, I never believed in it very much to really get out of this thing. And they'd got out and were presumably over in the woods, over there among the pine trees across the little road. And you can't wait in a thing like this. So I got up to the front of the tunnel, and there I could see the night sky above. And I looked up, and I saw the German looking in. He's looking into the camp, fortunately. Well, there's no time to study him or anything, so I hoiked my bundles up one after another and followed them up, and then streaked across the little road, hauled myself out, streaked across the little road and into those heavenly pine trees which gave cover. And there was no shot, no shouting, no nothing. We discovered later, we all said we'd crawl across this road like commandos, sure, highly disciplined people and all so on and so forth. But we'd gone across that road, each of us in turn, at 100 yards sprint speed, without any doubt. And we wanted to get away from that lighted area and those goons in the boxes. Out in the woods, we separated. There'd been a careful plan for this. I was going separately, and those two were going themselves, which he'd arranged before. And they went one part of the pine woods, and I went to some other part. And I took 22 minutes before I came out as Jan Jørgensen, the Norwegian businessman, black Antoniden hat, RAF greatcoat, which of course wouldn't be known in Germany, a greatcoat with the epaulettes removed by friendly Czechs who removed them on the night, or the night before, and viola shirt, a dowdy tie, an RAF black tie with some threading across it, made him a dowdy businessman, RAF gloves, a little case which unfortunately had British made on it, and that had taken a week to take in to some prisoners there who were good at art and so on, to smear stuff over the British maid so that a Hitler youth in the station wouldn't suddenly see that, which they'd see anything. And he got a lot of equipment in that case. And I'd got on Fleet Air Arm trousers and a jacket, which the clothing officer of the camp had produced for me. Which is the only one in the camp. I think he'd been out of the camp once already, but all sorts of rumours about it. But was a neat little coat with some large buttons sewn in by the side by the Czechs who had put buttons there to shout civilian. You had to keep, I think it was the left arm down all the time because it was a great jagged mending spot had been mended there, but apart from it, it's fairly respectable. Fleet Air on trousers were quite the thing. and Mercer had lent me those, which is very nice. And shoes, simply shoes, but with German shoelaces, which is important. And I then emerged, having got the last, what I hoped was the last, it wasn't really, but the last bit of sand out of my ears, and trying to look respectable. It was absolute hell walking along in that wood. Every sort of path or semi-path seemed to lead back to the wire. And for the first time, this is what gives you the lift, big lift, this, that you're seeing a prison camp from the outside, and you could hear the prisoners' voices. You almost hear sometimes what they said in clinking the basins about and preparing potatoes and so on for the evening meal and so on. And you get the right thing for escape. You're outside that bloody place. There was an errant wish to dash into the woods because they looked so safe. But this wasn't my sort of escape at all, nor the others. And one had to key oneself to come out of the cool of the woods and get off to Sargon Station, which was semi-lit or a poor blackout. And inside, of course, was brilliantly lit. And one took a deep breath and went in there. Of course, the first thing I saw was Lemnitz, the camp doctor, who's coming down some steps, who'd been traveling around somewhere, and he'd often found would-be escapers, or several times found would-be escapers at Sargon Station, and he just trotted them back. But I saw him first, and I leant down and I did up a shoelace, imaginary shoelace, which gave a lot of trouble. And he went by and didn't see me. And this incident was after, of course, I got my ticket, because falling in a queue there, I'd been for tickets. I'd been there some time before, I don't know quite how long, before I realized that the Frenchman, little Frenchman in front of me with a beret on, was none other than Michel Condé, Michael Codner, on his way out. And he went up to buy his ticket, and I'd run through the drill of this with him, and his German was quite indifferent. And the girl at the ticket office, instead of being an old crone, which we had always kidded ourselves would be somebody could hardly see and just hand out the tickets, a sharp-eyed young woman of 25 with a very zealous look about her, and she gave him a piercing glance and looked a bit doubtful, but nevertheless handed him his ticket. And then when my turn, Michael moved away quite a confident manner, pretty good, I thought. And when my turn came, I asked for a ticket to Custrin, and I could never say Custrin, I'm very bad at that, and asked for this ticket, and she sort of half-heartedly corrected the pronunciation of it, just a little bit, I thought, in reeling it back. And then she said, looked at me sharply and said, "Haben Sie vielleicht Kleingeld, bitte?" And I said, "Leider nein." And I handed her a note which I'd got.
She was asking for small change.
Yes, she was asking for small change. And if that question had come when Michael was there just in front of me, it would have floored him, because he didn't know the phrase, I'm sure. Anyway, I got my ticket and then swung away, and I saw another Frenchman in a beret looking at a large German notice as if he understood it, which none other than Eric Williams on the moving out of Germany as Marcel Levasseur, French worker. And up on the platform, this train was due. It is a Berlin Express. It was due at 7 o'clock, and we got there distinctly before 7. And those two marched up and down the platform, and I marched down the platform. We decided on principle to keep separate. And I got out a mannequin cigar. I was a bit cocky at that stage and lit a mannequin cigar without the band indicating the name. And I remember finishing it, because it took an age for this express to arrive, and I threw it out on the track with a spiral of sparks. It was a stupid thing to do. But Williams and Codner report they don't remember this. Of course, one's in a high state of tension, really. And then at 7:15, no train. Meanwhile, the lights of the camp are just over there. You're listening for the commandant to ring the bells and ring up the station and say, "Get my boys back." And there's no telephone, it doesn't ring, it's all right. Then at last, 7:28, there's a great wailing sound, a huge, great steam locomotive, ooh, ooh, came roaring in from Breslau and heading towards the Berlin Express, and it came snorting in. Unlike the film, which is slightly faulty in this case, that they show Codner and Williams as going up on the platform and jumping into a nearly moving train. Actually, it was this awful hangabout, but there are very few criticisms I have of the Wooden Horse film, which I think is pretty good, actually. And I got in crowded, which is what I wanted. Jan Jurgensen was a man for crowds. He mixed with people, and boldly. Once he's a forlorn character out there somewhere, he wasn't making it. And there were Luftwaffe men, there were soldiers, there were chaps, soldiers from the Ostfront with the East Front ribbon and all the rest of it, and some old women and some young people and so on. Very crowded express, and off it went, snorting away, and I was able to see the second great moment, see the lights of Stalag Luft 3 disappear across the pine trees, disappear away with every click of the wheels, and that was tremendous. And we got into Frankfurt, and by which time I was thinking this thing might come off, probably outside the various stations which the commandant will have phoned. We've broken the ring, I hope. Got out at Frankfurt station, did not see the other two at all, nor want to. We'd only get confused, we got mixed up. And I eyed the way out carefully, and I couldn't see. There was too terrible a check. I didn't know what to do if it was a stringent check. And I went out and offered my ticket. And this is quite okay. The various fellows in brown, or the SR, the SA people, large great belts and revolvers around in the offing, but they weren't grilling people, they weren't holding them up. And I said, Kustrin, that's my station, it's a bit north, a little on a local line, and I said, would I get this? And they said, oh, not tonight, they said. And I said, well, surely it's a 6:56. It was a train, 10 o'clock, I think it was, or something like that, that night. And they said, no, it's not running. It's the 6:50